and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Annie Leonard, author of The Story of Steph, and Dennis McLaren from the EPA. They both gave a keynote address at the Alaska Forum on the Environment last week. Regional Administrator of EPA Region 10, Dennis McLaren's talk focused on the wide array of EPA projects happening in Alaska right now, with the latest update on the Bristol Bay Assessment. We'll get to that in the second half of the show. First, Annie Leonard's keynote address on The Story of Steph, recorded at the Alaska Forum on the Environment Conference in Anchorage on Monday, February 4th.
Hi there. Boy, this is a lot of people. I'm Bill Huebner. I work for the National Park Service. I'm the Environmental Management Programs Coordinator for them in the Alaska region. And about 4 years ago, my supervisor said, you know, you really got to check out this Story of Steph video. It's really amazing. It's on the internet. And just Google Story of Steph and find it and watch it. And it's about 20 minutes long, and I watched it, and I was blown away. It's just absolutely amazing. And it's all about our consumer culture and the environmental and social costs that are associated with all of our consumerism and our throwaway society, where a lot of it just ends up in the garbage. So a lot of years I've been coming to the forum, and Doug Mutter down here, who is recently retired, he worked for Department of Interior, and now he is in Tucson. And he always said, Bill, who would you like to see speak at the Alaska Forum? And I always say, Annie Leonard, you got to get her. And then this year I get this email, Bill, you got Annie Leonard, now you got to pay up. So I paid up a little bit, and they paid up some more, and we got her here, and I'm just totally excited to have Annie Leonard. So come on up.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is my first time to Alaska. I'm just enormously grateful for the opportunity to be here, to see old friends and new, to share the stage with Ophelia. And this is the first time I've ever looked at a bunch of empty plastic bottles and felt good. This is absolutely beautiful. Special thanks to Kurt and the Alaska Environmental Forum for bringing me here, to the elders who are here with us today, and to the students, to tomorrow's leaders, and to all of you that are working for a better environment. I had so much fun walking around and looking at the different booths out there, and often people ask me how I stay so optimistic in spite of the increasingly grim data about the state of the planet. And the way that I stay so optimistic is by staying in touch with people that are working for solutions. And there are so many in this room, so it is an enormous honor and pleasure to be here with all of you. So, for those of you who've seen The Story of Steph, you know that I am obsessed with Steph. I'm just curious, how many people have seen this film? It's a 20-minute film on the internet. Oh, a lot of you. Excellent. So it's a 20-minute film that looks at where our Steph comes from and where it goes. It basically runs through the life cycle of all the Steph in our lives. And what that film does in 20 minutes, I do all the time. Like, I can't turn it off. Like, when I walk around, I look at things like this microphone. I imagine the mines in Africa where the metals were made, and maybe the chemical factory in southern India or Gujarat where the chemicals were put together, and the huge assembly plant in China where it was all put together, and maybe the trees in Alaska that were cut down to make the packaging for it, and the big ship that carried it. And I'm constantly doing this all day, which is why I'm a little disoriented. It's a stunning way to go through the day. I'm not complaining. If any of you are looking for some kind of neurosis to pick up, I really want to recommend this, because you never run out of things to think about. But it is a little disorienting, and it is a little bit lonely, which is why I'm so happy to be here with people who also think about these kinds of issues. So my fascination with Steph really started when I was a college student in New York City. I went to college right in Manhattan, and my dorm was on 110th Street, and my college was on 116th Street, so I'd walk those 6 blocks every day, and it's unbelievable how much garbage there is. The entire 6 blocks, it would be shoulder-high piles of garbage the entire way. There is so much garbage there. And I actually grew up in Seattle. We pride ourselves on being very environmental. We do not have piles of garbage all over the place. So that's where I picked up my habit. habit, which I still have to this day, it's another one I recommend, is I started looking in the garbage. It is so interesting when you go places to look in the garbage. You find out so much about what that community values, about trade patterns, about divisions of labor. It's like reading a society's secret journal. So I'm going to be looking in the garbage can before I leave the convention center today. If anyone wants to join me, please do. I hope we do not see a lot of those cups in there because you're going to use your same cup all week. Anyway, so I looked in these garbage cans and looked in these garbage bags. And one of the things that really amazed me is that it was mostly paper. And you know, in the United States, in the lower 48, I don't know what the numbers are here, but down in the lower 48, about 40% of our garbage is paper. And there's so much talk about the garbage crisis. If we just used both sides, recycled, got off junk mailing lists, there's so many things we could do that would cut our garbage almost in half. So I just started thinking more about the stuff. And I wanted to know where it goes. It was there every morning on the way to school, and when I'd come back, it was gone. I said, where did all that stuff go? And so I took a trip out to the landfill where New York City's garbage goes. It's on Staten Island. Its name, this is actually true, is Fresh Kills Landfill. And it is an awesome experience. Just, it was stunning for me as a sophomore in college to look at. Now, I've seen photographs of the landfills in the villages here. It's similar times like 90 bazillion. It is so huge. As far as I could see in every direction was appliances and furniture and packaging and books. I couldn't believe it. I was taught to respect books. There's books in the landfill and food. It was incredible. It is so huge that it is the highest point on the eastern seaboard. Legend has it that along with the Great Wall of China, it's one of two man-made structures you can see from space. I mean, this was absolutely massive, and it struck me right then and there, looking out and just seeing waste in every direction, that we have a fundamental design flaw in our economy, that it is not sustainable to turn resources into waste in such a fast pace and then to keep it hidden from view. I wondered, why do we have so much waste, and how could I go all the way until I was a sophomore in college before realizing this? So I decided to figure it out. Imagine my parents' delight after they save up my whole life, send me off to college in New York City. They said, what are you going to do, honey? Be an architect, a doctor? I said, no, garbage, Mom. I found my calling. And that is basically what I've done since. So after I finished college, I decided to figure out where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And I was lucky enough to get a job that allowed me to spend over 10 years traveling the world looking at where our stuff comes from and where it goes. This is the basic system, and you'll recognize this from the story of stuff. This is what we look at in the film. Extraction, production, distribution, consumption, and disposal. That is the life cycle of all of our stuff, but we tend to only see the consumption part. We tend to only see from the store to our house to the dump, and all the rest happens out of sight, out of mind. So I got to travel to over 40 countries, and I visited hundreds of factories where our stuff is made and dumps where our stuff is dumped. And I got to see firsthand the hidden environmental and social and economic and health costs behind all of the consumer products that we use in our day-to-day life. I summarized what I'd seen in this film. It's very humbling to have basically 20 years of adult research summarized into a 20-minute film, but I did it. I made this film because I wanted more people to join me in thinking about where our stuff comes from and where it goes and how we could do it better. I put the film up on the internet. You can all watch it at storyofstuff.org. In 2007, and my goal, in my wildest dreams, I thought, well, what if 50,000 people would watch this film? If 50,000 people would watch this film, we could really turn the volume up on this much-needed conversation about how we make and use and throw away stuff. And to my utter amazement, 50,000 people watched it the first day. We have now had over 36 million views. It is the most watched online environmental film in history, thanks to those of you who watched it and shared it. Thank your boss at the Park Service. He helped to get us up there. And I can actually go to Google Maps and see a dot everywhere in the world someone has watched it. It's now every single country in the world. It has been translated into about 40 different languages. The first year, I got 250,000 emails from people who had questions. And I was so excited because I'd spent 20 years trying to get anyone to talk to me about this stuff, and no one wanted to talk to me. So I was so excited that I would put my child to bed and then try to stay up and answer all these emails, and it wasn't working. And so what I did is I collected all the answers and I wrote a book, and we do have the book back there, The Story of Stuff, and I hope the libraries and schools will get it so that you can all read it without buying it. But I summarized everything that I'd found in the 20 years. I want to now share some of the updates since I made this film. Let's start with the bad news. we'll get this over with, because at this point, basically, we all know this, and it's not that fun to talk about it. I feel like the planet is in serious trouble. It is headed towards an ecological cliff. We don't have to have a bad day on top of that, so I won't spend a lot of time here. But the bottom line is that things are not looking good. Across many fronts, if you look at a whole bunch of indicators of the planet health and human well-being, we are on a bad trajectory. Water use, paper consumption, biodiversity loss, plastic garbage in the ocean, number of cars, amount of garbage, CO2 in the atmosphere. Pretty much every indicator you look at these days is looking like this. And it's not just the planet's health, it's our health too. Huge increases in the heavily consumptive parts of the world in diabetes, heart disease, inequality, even social isolation and depression. I mean, the good news about this is that we basically only need one graph anymore. That's what's happening right now, is the bad stuff. Now, this bad news can be overwhelming, so I just want to boil it down to one hard truth, one thing we need to fix, and that is that we are using too much stuff. We are using and wasting too much stuff. We're using too much water, too much fiber, too much fish, too much fossil fuels, too much minerals, too much plastic. We're actually using more than the planet can produce each year and creating more waste than the planet can assimilate. The Global Footprint Network tracks how much we use compared to how much the planet can produce. And right now they say that we're using 1.5 planets worth of resources each year. And that means we're using 1.5 times what the planet can replenish. Now, how can we do that when we only have one planet? It's because we only became such ravenous consuming pigs recently. And so nature had eons to build up all this stuff that we're now eating into. But you can't use 1.5 planets indefinitely. I was actually at an environmental conference recently, and I presented this data, and a debate broke out in the audience where some people said, no, the data, it's 1.3 planets. We're using 1.3 planets. And somebody else said, no, we're using 1.7 planets. I said, guys, big picture here. Anything over one is a problem. We have one planet. We have simply got to learn how to live within the limits of that one planet that we have. Our planet is stressed. But enough on this. You all know this. If you didn't know this, you wouldn't be here at this environmental forum learning about it. You know, at this point, to not know that the planet is in trouble, you'd have to be living in a cave or working at Fox News. Now, let's get to the good news. Unfortunately, there is good news. There are so many solutions to the problems that we face. The people who say there is no alternative are not actually looking for one. Now, this is really, really important to know, because if these problems were intractable, it would be really hard to get out of bed in the morning. But the truth is, there are so many solutions right on the shelf, ready to go, that we really can begin to turn things around and chart a different trajectory. We can do so much better. I like to think of the solutions as like a giant smorgasbord buffet. There's like all different kinds of solutions for all different kinds of people. They're sort of divided into three different categories. It's one of the easy ways to sort of make sense of all the solutions that are out there is divide them into the categories of where we most need them. We need them in our companies and business. Those are technical solutions, design solutions. We need them in our communities. We need cultural solutions there. And we need them in our government that often comes in the form of different better policies and programs. And we are only going to really fix these problems. We are only going to figure out how to live sustainably and healthily in this one planet we have if all three of those sectors work together: government, companies, and people. So let's look at the companies. There's so many technical solutions. One of the things I love to do, because I'm a wonk about this stuff, is read some of the industrial design journals about some of the new things that are coming. Oh my God, it's so exciting. There's so many ways to reduce water use, reduce energy use, reduce toxic chemical use, reduce waste, like all kinds of things. And the leading businesses, the sustainable and successful businesses of tomorrow, they are leading the way on this because they realize there is no business on a dead planet. So the amazing things that we're seeing. One example is green chemistry. Green chemistry is sort of interesting. Right now, we're using a lot of toxic chemicals in our everyday products. We have about 80 to 100,000 synthetic chemicals in our everyday products. It's in the upholstery of these chairs. It's in our sunscreen. It's in our clothes. It's in our furniture. It's in our food. It's in our electronics and cell phones. We use so many synthetic chemicals. But why are they so toxic? It's not because there's some mean chemist in some lab, like, figuring out how to poison us. It's because when so many of these chemicals were invented right after World War II, toxicity just wasn't on the chemist's radar screen. They were taught to invent chemicals that had certain reactive components or catalyzed different things or were adhesive or had all these different factors, but they weren't taught to think about how they interact with biological systems. So but by accident, a lot of them were hazardous. It's not necessary that they be hazardous. So some chemists are now going back to the drawing board, redesigning chemicals from the molecular level to design the hazard out. So they have the same function without the hazard. That's called green chemistry. It's a booming field now. The students, the chemistry students who are studying green chemistry are getting jobs before they even graduate because companies realize if they can use green chemistry, they don't have to buy hazardous chemicals. They don't have to buy expensive worker protection gear. They don't have to pay for hazardous waste disposal because they've just eliminated the danger. That's one of the ones that gets me really excited. Another one is biomimicry. Biomimicry is the idea that we can look to nature to figure out how to solve some of our design and engineering challenge because nature has been at it a lot longer than we have. So there's examples like black. If you're a company that makes black pigment for fabric, the black pigment tends to be very toxic, so it has all kinds of worker exposure and environmental impacts. So biomimicry scientists said, how does the peacock make black? Or you know, how does nature make black? Because nature doesn't make toxics just as an accident. So they looked really closely at the peacock, and it turns out the black in a peacock is not a pigment of black. It's the illusion of black or the perception of black based on the way that the chemicals come together. So we see black even though it's not there. So now furniture upholstery makers are mimicking the peacock and making black upholstery, zero toxic chemicals, zero worker exposure, zero hazardous waste, and it doesn't even fade in the sunlight. Or another one that I think is really cool are these giant anthills in Africa. These anthills are in the desert where it is searing hot in the day and really, really cold at night. Not this cold, but really cold at night. And yet those anthills stay the same temperature inside 24 hours a day. They have no coal-fired power plant and heating and ventilation system. How do they do that? So architects are now studying that and looking to mimic that in our buildings. Imagine if we could have buildings that were built, were designed to stay the same temperature 24 hours a day all year round. Some solutions like those are higher tech and more complicated. Some are really basic and simple, like composting. This is a picture of a smaller scale and a larger scale composting facility. Cities and villages all over the world are separating out their organic material, their food waste, their yard waste, their landscaping waste, and then composting it instead of putting it in the landfill. That is an incredibly good thing to do. It not only extends the life of the landfill, not only creates a soil amendment to this compost that you can then sell, but it keeps the organics out of the landfill. If you put organic stuff in landfills, it biodegrades and creates methane, which is a greenhouse gas 23 times more powerful than CO2. So this is actually excellent for the economy, excellent for the environment, and really good for the climate. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many solutions that companies can do better. We can also do better in our communities. We need to develop cultural solutions, different social norms in our communities. Right now, our communities and social lives have really been oriented around a kind of hyper-consumption so that our recreation, often our education, our demonstration of our social worth is largely connected to what we own. In our pop culture society, we value people based on their clothes and their car and if they have a cool cell phone and how big of a house they have, rather than valuing people on who they are, on how they show up in their community. So we need to resist this sort of excessive commercialization that has poisoned our community and nurture values and activities that are not about buying more stuff, but that are about working together for a better solution. One of the cultural solutions that's having a huge explosion around the country is sharing. I mean, sharing is so popular now that it has a new fancy name. It's now called collaborative consumption, formerly known as sharing. People are beginning to look at sharing, at building the culture and infrastructure for sharing, because sharing is good for the environment. We don't all need to own every single thing. It's good for our household budgets, because you don't have to buy everything. And it's good for our communities, because you have to talk to each other. So in my town, where I live in California, our public library system has a tool lending library. So I can go in there with my library card and borrow a jackhammer, a drill. Do you know the average power drill in the United States? Guess how long the average power drill is used during its entire lifetime? 15 minutes. 15 minutes. People buy this thing at Home Depot or Walmart or whatever, use it to do their one thing they got to do, and it is never used again. And yet there are idle drills in every single house. There's often two because you can't find where you put the first one because you haven't used it for so long. So you got to buy another one. Like, it is absolutely crazy. So even though sharing sounds like a kindergarten lesson, it really is a simple yet radical way to redefine our relationship with stuff. And there are some great online platforms like FreeCycle, or another one that's new, it's called Yurtle. You can go to yurtle.com, where you can put on there, do you need to borrow something? Do you have something you want to get rid of? It's a great way to get what you need without shopping and get rid of what you need without throwing it in the landfill. So there's lots of things we can do better in our communities. We can also do better in our governments. Now, governments cannot solve all problems. I mean, they certainly cannot solve them alone without engaged citizens and businesses. But they can and they should help. Isn't that why we have a government? Don't we have a government to solve problems that are too big for us to solve alone? But yet we have let our government get away for too long with not being leaders on so many of these fronts where they could be. Let me just talk about toxic chemicals for a moment. I'm really fascinated with toxic chemicals. I've done an enormous amount of studying on toxic chemicals, and I am super uptight about I don't want toxic chemicals in me. I am so uptight and vigilant that I would not wish my level of uptightness on any of you because it gets to be a drag to be around me. Like, I screen everything going into my house. There are no PVCs, no Teflon frying pans, no BPA. There's no Scotchgard on my carpets. I buy organic food. I even buy my furniture used so that it off-gassed at someone else's house instead of in my house. Like, I am as vigilant as you can be because I want to protect myself and my family from toxic chemicals. Yet I had my own body burden tested. Body burden refers to the level of toxic chemicals that we all carry. Toxic chemicals are so prevalent in our consumer products that every single person on Earth now carries some level of body burden of these toxic chemicals. And when I went in to get my test done, I said, I am so uptight. This is going to be a breeze. I'm going to come out so high. I was stunned. My body is loaded with toxic chemicals. Chemicals that I never gave permission to any company to put inside me. Chemicals that I never knowingly applied to my skin or ingested, yet I, just like all of you, am carrying these around. Protecting ourselves from toxic chemicals is one of the many examples of things that we simply cannot solve on an individual level. We need the government to be much more proactive in terms of protecting the entire community. We're very lucky that the European Union has taken this very seriously and has experimented with a whole bunch of different model policies, so we can look at them and see what worked and what didn't. Just as an example, personal care products, and we have a film about this, the story of cosmetics. Personal care products like sunscreen, toothpaste, lipstick, shampoo, have a lot of toxic chemicals in this country. It's pretty much unregulated. You can put whatever you want. In total, our country has banned 11 chemicals in personal care products. In Europe, they've banned 11,000. So if all of these companies can make lipstick without neurotoxins and baby shampoo without reproductive toxins and sunscreen without carcinogens in Europe, why can't they do it here? That's the kind of leadership we need to see from our government. Another way government can do leadership is give higher standards to spur innovation. Things like higher gas mileage, toxics use reduction targets, all kinds of things to get our companies to get on board. Right now, our government is stuck. We have not passed a major environmental law since 1970. The threats have changed enormously since the 70s. Our understanding of the threats have also changed. We have got to get our government to quit their bickering, get back on, I'm talking about Congress, not all the local government people in this room, back on track to create some real solutions. Here's another example that just happened in my town that's had a huge benefit. We all know the damage with plastic bags. Not only is it a waste of oil to ship the oil around the world, make a bag that you use for 10 minutes and then throw it away, but they're enormous disposal problems. They don't stay in landfills. They migrate around. They clog up drains. Wildlife eats them. They get into the ocean. They're killing animals, and a lot of animals mistake them for squid in the ocean, so then they eat them, and then they actually die of starvation because they feel like their stomachs are full because they ate all these plastic bags, but there's no nutrients. Plastic bags are a mess. They are a menace. They should not exist. And so environmentalists for years did all kinds of education, asking people, please don't use plastic bags. 10 reasons why you shouldn't use plastic bags. It didn't work. So now communities all over, including my county just did this, just banned plastic bags. Said enough of this. These things are a menace. The benefit that they provide society does not merit the hassles that they produce. So as of January 1st, plastic bags are banned. Everybody carries their own bags to the store. It's so easy. You just leave your bags in the car or in your bike. I asked the store clerk, are people bringing their own bags? She said, totally. Like a thousandfold increase since before this ban. That is a simple thing to do. And one of the biggest allies on the plastic bag bans have been local governments. Because if your community is using plastic bags, local governments are stuck with the cleanup bill of figuring out how to dispose them. And it's expensive to figure out how to dispose them. So a thing like a plastic bag ban, good for the environment and good for the economy, because then the government can use all that money for other solutions. Now, a lot of people might say some of these ideas are kind of radical and I'm some extremist environmentalist, but carrying your own bag to the store is pretty basic. And if you ask your grandparents, I'll bet they carried their own bags to the store. A lot of things I'm talking about are just getting back to common sense. Now, each of these kinds of solutions, the cultural, the policy, and technical, they all feed on each other. So as we begin to change our cultural norms, like we get tired of seeing all this garbage, then that lays the foundation for stronger policies. Then better policies lay the foundation and spur technological innovation. And then technological innovations help cultures live even more sustainably. So they're all important. People often ask me, what's the most important one? Where's the most important place to push? And that depends where you are and what leverage point you have. If you're a school teacher, you can do all kinds of work promoting different cultural norms, or a religious leader can promote different cultural norms. If you work in government, work on policy, or if you want to be an engaged citizen, pressure the government to work on policy. And if you work in companies, get involved in the technical solutions. The point is they all need to be done. And the other thing that's really important, besides the fact that we need all of them, is we need them now. The sense of urgency is great. If all of these solutions are implemented, if they're implemented on all different fronts, we really can have a society that is sustainable, that is healthy, that is fair, and that is much more fun than we're having now. We need to hold that vision that it is absolutely possible. The old school way of thinking about this is that we have to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy environment, and that is so 1980s. The new way to think about this is that in order to have a healthy economy, we have to have a healthy environment, and in order to have a healthy environment, we have to have a healthy economy. So there's absolutely possible to do both. But that leaves us with the question that if these solutions are already, if it's so possible, if they work economically and environmentally, why aren't they happening? So for a long time, I thought it's that people don't know about the problem. We need to tell people about the problem, and then these changes will happen. But you know what it turns out? Most people at this point know that there's a problem. I saw this when I made the story of Stuff. I sort of feel like the story of Stuff took the temperature of the public and we got back this enormous flood that people said, yes, I knew that, I'm concerned. If you look at the polls, most people at this point know that there is a problem. So then I thought, okay, well, maybe they don't care. Maybe it's they know, but they don't care, so we need to convince them to care. But then that turns out to not be it. Again, if you look at the data, most people care about these problems. It turns out most people want water that's clean to drink. Most people don't want to carry around hundreds of toxic chemicals in their body or have neurotoxins in their lipstick or in their baby shampoo or in their mattresses in their beds. Most people want a better future. Some of the recent data, 74% of people want stricter regulations on toxic chemicals. Over 80% of people support transitioning to a clean energy economy. Over 90% of people think that corporations have too much influence in our democracy and are blocking progress. Those are really, really high numbers. The problem is not that we need to convince more people to care. These are numbers that are so high they would have been the envy of any social movement in the past. These are higher numbers of support than Martin Luther King had in fighting segregation. These are higher numbers of support than women had in fighting to get the right to vote. Higher numbers of support than the abolitionists had in ending slavery. We have most people on our side. What's missing is moving all of our shared knowledge and concern to action. We are what's missing. Although most people care about these things, they have not yet figured out what to do. They know there's a problem, they don't know what to do about it. An informed, engaged public, like all of you in this room, demanding solutions from ourselves, from our neighbors, from our businesses, and from our government, is our only missing piece. It is up to us to chart a different future. Now, people often ask me, do I think change is possible? I say, we're using 1.5 planets and we have one, duh. Definitely we are gonna change. You can't use 1.5 planets indefinitely if you only have one. Change is not only possible, it is inevitable. The question is not if we are gonna change, but how we are going to change. Because either way, our children's children's children are going to be using a lot less resources than we are now. So either we are going to change by design, or we're going to change by disaster. Either way, it's going to be hard work. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to cost some money. But if we change by design, if we be intentional and strategic about it, we can do it so much better. It can be so much more fair, so much smarter. If we refuse to change, if we dig our heels in and say that the American way of life is non-negotiable and we are not budging, change is still coming, but it's going to be a lot uglier, a lot less fair. That's change by disaster. I like to think of it as we're on a bus, and the bus is going to be turning. It is definitely going to be turning. And we have a choice to be at the driver's seat or get run over. But either way, the bus is turning. So the question is not if we are going to change, but how. And it is up to us. So please get engaged, which you already are from here. When you go home, talk to your family members, talk to your neighbors, talk to your schoolmates and your classmates and your colleagues in the business. Get them to get engaged. Find organizations that are working on the things that you like. The Story of Stuff has a community. You can sign up at the Story of Stuff and stay in touch with us. We have lots of different ideas to get involved. Locally, there are so many great organizations like the one out there, like ACAT, like so many others. Get involved, because if we work together, we absolutely can turn things around. Build a sustainable, healthy, and just society ahead. Thank you so much. How am I doing?
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Annie Leonard, author of The Story of Stuff. Her keynote address at the Alaska Forum on the Environment was recorded in Anchorage on Monday, February 4th. Now we'll hear another keynote address from the conference. Regional Administrator for EPA Region 10, Dennis McLaren. He was recorded speaking at the Alaska Forum on Wednesday, February 6th.
Dennis was appointed by the President to serve as the Regional Administrator for Region 10. It amazes me that this man has 650 employees. I can't even boss my little wish dog, my little wishbone around. He's a Jack Russell. And he's got 650 people that he's responsible for. He's responsible for $500 million annual budget. Dennis, is it going to go up? I hope. Your $5 million. And his bio is on page 28. So let's welcome Dennis again to Alaska. Thank you, Dennis.
So thank you, Elaine, and thank you all for, and Kurt, thank you all for inviting me to come back and talk to you again this year. I want to recognize the tribal elders in the audience, and also want to recognize several people that I see out in the audience. Larry Hardig from Alaska DEC. I see Paul Kluckner from Environment Canada there. Thanks, Paul, for coming back again. I've seen you at the conference several years in a row. Again, thanks everyone on this beautiful day for inviting me back to Alaska. I spent the day yesterday up in Barrow, and so if I I'm a little sleepy up here, it's because I got up at 3:30 in the morning yesterday and got the 6 o'clock plane and spent the day with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission up there, and it was a beautiful sunny day. It was minus 20 and minus 45 degree wind chill, but the sun was out and it was a gorgeous day up there. But I didn't get back until around midnight last night to my hotel, so hopefully I'll deliver this with energy and a punch, but I'm a little tired. Anyway, this is my third year at the Alaska Forum, and having been given the opportunity to speak here, and it really is one of my favorite events every year. It can always be tricky to fit in everything that I want to fit in when I'm up here in Alaska, and we took a little risk going to Barrow that I wouldn't get trapped up there with ice fog and not get back here for the speech, but here I am, and glad to be here, and really glad to have this opportunity one more time to talk to you. And my staff looks forward to, you know, my coming up here for this speech every year as well. I get up here multiple times during the year, and I try and get out to communities, villages, well outside of Anchorage, but it's always fun to get a chance to come to this conference, because I think this conference is a great place to meet with people and to see a really large and representative group of folks in Alaska every year. And I look forward to coming here and talking at this conference because the work we do in Alaska is really interesting and challenging, and that makes my job fascinating, and it's always fun to talk about the work that we're doing. And this conference covers really the broad sweep of much of what's going on here in the state and allows a great exchange of information to occur over the week of the conference. So kudos to the conference organizers, and it's supported so well by the people that come and show up every year and support it with sponsorships and so on. So really glad to be here. And the issues up here are tough issues oftentimes that we're involved in. You guys know this as well as I do. The tough work is really worthwhile up here because it's ultimately about the people here who live here. It's about the people and their communities and their livelihoods, and getting to know how our work at EPA affects people is what this is all about, and it's why I got into this line of work and in the first place, and it's I'm sure it's why a number of you have done the same thing and dedicated your time to these issues, because they're so important to the people. In Alaska, where the connection between people and natural resources is so close, the issues seem to be of a more personal nature than maybe in other places in the lower 48. And that's why our office in Alaska, having 50 people here in Alaska from EPA, full-time Alaska residents, is so important. And for our team here, it's their everyday work to be engaged in these issues. I get to come up here three or four times a year and get out to communities and villages and so on, but the people that work here are doing this every day. And for me, this conference is always important, and my trips up here out to communities are important because I want to hear directly from Alaskans, no matter what their perspectives may be, pro or con, about the work that EPA is doing, because these are your communities, your state, your jobs, and your fish. And so it's really important for me to hear from the people here so that I can come back, and when we make decisions, we've got your perspectives. I can see with your eyes. I've been in your communities. I've worked with my staff that live in Alaska and know these issues so well. And the closer that we at EPA can be to the perspectives of Alaskans, the better our decisions, our decision-making will be, and the better the work will be as well. And I do consider folks like Larry Hartig to be a friend as well, because they help me stay grounded. We talk quite a bit, and sometimes we don't always agree on the issues, but it gives me a sense of the best way to tackle some of these issues, and the perspectives of everybody in this room are things that I value. And I think we do have a very good partnership with the state as well. We also maintain good relationships with the state's congressional delegation. Our staffs are in pretty frequent contact, and we make sure that we know the complexities that they're facing and the issues that they want us to pay attention to as well. And we all know there are a lot of complexities when it comes to Alaska, so you all know about that. And you all are involved in some of the very high-profile, very complex issues we're involved in, issues like oil and gas exploration and our Bristol Bay watershed assessment, air quality issues up in Fairbanks. But today, I want to talk to some of the issues that are not quite as high-profile. In addition to the big high-profile issues like those and the big projects that make headlines in the newspaper, the EPA crew in Alaska are involved in some really important work projects that just keep Alaska and its communities moving forward. This work doesn't garner a lot of headlines or a lot of political attention, but it's really important work done in partnership with Alaska's villages and communities and the state of Alaska. And I want to highlight some of that work from the Alaska EPA staff today, who are deeply involved in that work. So let me take a couple of minutes to talk about this work. Some of it I'm sure you're aware of, but some of it you may not be aware of as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our EPA staff in Alaska, too. I'm going to do a little bit of bragging about some of our folks that work up here, because they're doing great work. They're working with many of you on issues like tank farm inspections in rural communities, on wetlands preservation to protect aquatic resources and water quality, on brownfields where folks like Mary Gooley and others on our staff have helped dozens of communities from across the state, from Anchorage to Quetluck, to clean up and reuse old sites, and they use EPA grant money and EPA staff assistance to put those projects together, and we work with the state on those as well. We're helping communities to come up with alternative solid waste handling approaches, such as our landfill in a box program and assistance to backhaul programs through our GAP funding. We're working with villages on adaptation strategies for climate change, on ocean disposal, such as dealing with waste from the Japanese tsunami, where the state, again, has taken a strong lead on that, and we're engaged on that as well. And investments in capacity building for tribes, which is an area of particular importance for the agency as a whole, but is really obviously a most acute need here in Alaska. As another example, we review every large project EIS in the state to help bring consistency as well as tribal and community concerns to the federal decision-making process. And this is part of our work to help tribal communities develop capacity to effectively engage in resource extraction projects that affect them. That's why we've been so involved in the development of the North Slope Communications Protocol to communicate with folks up on the North Slope and their communities effectively around resource extraction projects. And in fact, we're often asked by other federal agencies how to communicate better with tribal communities because tribal communities have told them that EPA is a model for how to do that better. And that's a great example of something I've said before, but in these speeches, but bears repeating. The EPA has a team of knowledgeable, dedicated professionals living and working here in the state who are Alaskans through and through. They live here, they play here, and their families are part of the communities. And it's a team that lets us do the work that makes a big difference on the day-to-day environmental and human health issues that communities across the state are dealing with. So let me get a little more specific and give you some more specific examples of what some individuals on our staff are doing. I'd like to introduce you to Jack Guzmano, a wildlife biologist and a chemist who's a Superfund project manager for us. Jack's lived and worked in Alaska for 31 years, and he knows and cares about Alaska, and that's why we at the agency rely on him so heavily. And it's why he's so respected in the communities where he does his work. A great example of this is work he's been doing on Prince of Wales Island on the Salt Chuck Mine cleanup site, where the main contaminant is copper. All the residents on this island receive a significant proportion of their food through subsistence, so understanding the food sources and the level of contamination in them is critical to determining what remedies would go furthest with a limited amount of dollars in the cleanup. And sure enough, early in the investigations, clams were found to be contaminated with high levels of copper and arsenic. But after Jack's close interaction with stakeholders in the community on the island, it seemed that the higher priority for the communities is actually shrimp and crab harvesting. And so our plan, our cleanup plan there, will prioritize prevention of tailings erosion into the bay. And while that may not seem like much to the communities that need to prioritize where the government spends its limited cleanup dollars, Jack's presence and deep involvement helped figure out a better, more protective cleanup plan that reflected the community's priorities and targeted cleanup where it would make the biggest difference. And after the last meeting that he had recently in the village president and the village historian recognized Jack and the staff's efforts in a very moving ceremony there. It was an act of appreciation by the tribe, and while it didn't make news all over the state, it was really important. And another example that I'll give is Dennis Wagner, a public health service officer in our Anchorage office, who manages three programs that fund water and wastewater infrastructure projects in rural Alaska. And I got a chance to travel last summer to some communities, to several villages where these projects are being implemented with Dennis last summer. And Larry Hartig went on at least one of those visits with us as well. Jack's been working with tribes in the water and wastewater field for 27 years. Dennis has been working with folks on wastewater for 27 years. And His programs, in coordination with the state of Alaska, have provided over $600 million to address water and wastewater infrastructure needs, including homes in Alaska without these basic services. And Dennis's work will help ensure that 90% of the homes in these rural communities that have received these funds will have clean water and appropriate wastewater service. Again, really important in those communities, doesn't make headlines, but it's the kind of work that we do every day with people in communities in Alaska that's really important. Again, this is work we're involved in with all of you on a day-to-day basis, the work that doesn't make the headlines but makes a difference in communities everywhere. And I want to mention another staff member. Right up here is Tammy Fordham. A lot of you know Tammy. She's worked with Alaska Native tribal governments and communities as an IGAP coordinator and as our tribal advisor for large resource extraction projects. EPA provides IGAP funding for 280 tribes in the four Region 10 states, with the majority coming to Alaska. And our people do a significant amount of daily work to support this effort, and again, it's representative of EPA's commitment to respect and support tribal governments. One area of focus for Tammy is addressing how EPA should approach environmental justice when it comes to working with tribal governments and communities, as well as including environmental justice analysis and addressing EJ in permitting. Tammy has also taken on a big load in better incorporating traditional ecological knowledge into our agency work, including water permitting decisions in the Arctic. In fact, Tammy wants me to make sure that I note up here that on Wednesday morning there will be two TEK sessions that you can all attend. So make sure you listen in on those sessions with Tammy. But we've been incorporating TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, into major actions taken by the agency, such as the recent discharge for permits for Arctic exploratory drilling activities on the Outer Continental Shelf that I was up talking to whaling captains about yesterday. We spent time listening and learning about what was known and important to elders and others with TEK to make sure our permits were the best they could be. We view that as an important responsibility, and I'm very proud of that work by our EPA staff. Shifting gears now a little bit, though, since my speech last year here at the conference, a lot has happened on some of the higher profile issues we've been involved in as well. First, let's talk a little bit more about EPA's role in offshore oil and gas exploration. Our role there is to issue air pollution and water pollution permits that have been required by Congress under the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts to achieve appropriate protections for the environment and for people's health. And our people here in Alaska, down in Seattle, and even in Washington, D.C., work very hard to make sure we listen to everybody, that we understand their concerns, and then incorporate them to the fullest extent of our capabilities and our statutory authority into the permits. The results that we hope for when we write those permits and that we typically get are permits that protect our air and water based on the law and the science and the input we get from all the stakeholders in the process. And we've done that a number of times on permits. Getting those permits right takes a lot of time and resources on the part of the companies that are involved, the EPA, and the communities that are most affected and concerned about the impacts of the pollution. So these are often tough, controversial processes, but we've spent time in the affected communities, a lot of time in the affected communities, and with the companies involved to try and make the permits protective, responsive, timely, and the best that they can be. And it's often a thankless task for the staff involved, but I want to recognize their hard work today because I think it really does make a difference as this work goes forward in Alaska. And related to this work on exploration is also our work on spill response and preparedness. And again, this is another area that we're invested heavily in. And I know it's of enormous concern to communities around the state as it is to industry. And we share this responsibility with the state and with the Coast Guard and with other agencies. But a key person that I wanted to recognize from our staff today on this work is Marcia Combs. Marcia has been assigned to do this work for the last couple of years, but I'll bet most of you know Marcia from her time when she was our office director here in Anchorage before Diane Soderlund took on that role a year and a half or so ago. Marcia knows just about everyone. She's smart, she's energetic, she's strategic, and she's engaging, and she's just perfect for this really tough work on spill response. Aside from bringing Marcia to that work, what we bring to the regional response team effort, among other things, is technical know-how, relationships, and an understanding of tribal communities who are concerned at potentially at risk were something to go wrong with resource extraction activities. And there are multiple jurisdictions, there are different technical capabilities and different areas of expertise. So Marcia spends her time working closely with the Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, our Alaska and Seattle and Washington DC emergency response staff and other federal agencies and tribal communities to strengthen coordination and resource availability so that responders can implement a rapid and well-coordinated response. And part of this work is for us to provide outreach and capacity building to tribal communities and local responders in high-risk areas throughout Alaska in the area of basic oil spill response. And again, not work that draws headlines, but it's work that happens every single day and is going on and on an ongoing basis and wouldn't be happening if we weren't here. This year in 2013, we plan on doubling these efforts with two training venues within the inland zone that's EPA's primary area of responsibility. And consistent with our environmental justice priorities, the EPA and Coast Guard have now formed a task force within the Alaska Regional Response Team to enhance tribal involvement and awareness on preparedness priorities. The agencies have done the same for Endangered Species Act consultation on response tactics defined in the Alaska Unified Plan, where the use of dispersants would be one example of a response tactic that could be evaluated in this consultation. This is an enormous amount of technical work and coordination that just couldn't get done without Marcia and her team. She's an amazing asset and a natural resource right here in Alaska. Switching gears a little bit here, it seems to me that things are just a bit more complex up here in Alaska, where spill response can involve travel to remote areas in harsh, dangerous conditions. And part of our work is making sure that our colleagues in Washington, D.C. understand the nature of the work here. And one of the things that I try and do, something that I'm really dedicated to, is bringing key people from our Washington, D.C. headquarters out to Alaska so they can see how vast and challenging Alaska can be. I'll save that story for another day about getting all those folks out from Washington, D.C., but it's really important that they see it with their eyes and they get to stand in your shoes in your communities and see, you know, what some of the challenges are. But let me wrap up today by giving you an update on a topic that I know there's wide interest in, and that's our draft Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. I've talked to some of you this morning in a couple of different sessions that we had, but we indicated last year that at the end of last year that we would be asking for additional peer review of a revised document that incorporates consideration of the public comments we received on the May 2012 draft assessment, as well as the comments we received from the panel of 12 independent peer reviewers. And as most of you know, we received extensive public comment on the draft assessment as well. We received over 230,000 public comments once all of those were in, which is a pretty amazing number of public comments on a document like that. And I think you also know that we arranged a very robust peer review of the draft assessment back in August 2012 that was held up here in Anchorage. And that peer review meeting included a full day of time set aside to share public comments with the 12 reviewers. The independent peer reviewers received a summary of the full public comments and had access to all of the comments as well. So that process was quite extensive. And today, I'm announcing that we will be releasing a draft revised assessment document this spring and we'll be seeking additional public comment on that draft. We're making arrangements to have the original 12 independent experts review the revised assessment and evaluate whether the revised draft has been responsive to their peer review comments. And we intend to complete the assessment later in 2013 after this additional round of review and comment is completed. And our primary objective is to make sure that we have gotten the assessment right and are using the best available science. The Bristol Bay salmon runs are a national treasure, and no one wants to see them harmed. So we want to make sure that we have the best understanding possible of what the impacts of large-scale mining could be on the salmon. And as I've said previously, we haven't made any decisions yet about how we will use the information in the assessment, and will not do so until it's finalized. But we do expect the additional public comment period and peer review follow-up will be initiated before the spring fishing season begins, before the summer fishing season begins, by putting this out in early April with a 30-day comment period and that peer review to occur during that same time frame. And I will say just one more time, our objective in all of this is to get the assessment right. That means conducting and understanding and delivering the best available science about the possible impacts of large-scale mining on fish. And that needs to be and will remain our primary focus before any decisions on Bristol Bay mining development are made. So that's the news on Bristol Bay and some thoughts on the importance we place on the other issues every day that Alaskans are concerned about up here in the state. And there's no doubt that we'll be working hard with the state, tribal governments, project proponents, and a lot of you on other issues that I've not mentioned today. Big issues like Donlin Creek Mine, the Susitna-Wetana Dam, the Chewitna Mine, and a long list of other major projects that are proposed up here in Alaska. I and our EPA staff look forward to continuing our work together, both on the high-profile projects, but perhaps even more importantly, on the continuing work of capacity building, village infrastructure development, and redevelopment and emergency response, those other issues that I mentioned today. So in the meantime, on behalf of our amazing Alaska EPA staff, only a few of which I had time to mention today, I thank you again for your time and for your partnership and appreciate the opportunity every year to get up here and speak with you.
So we'll have some time to meet Dennis a short while right after this, but not very long. He has a meeting to go to, but I am going to put him on the spot. And now Diane's quite nervous. What's Kurt going to do to my boss? But I am going to ask him to share with all of you a personal moment that he'll remember about Alaska, something he's done in his career up here, and share something that he'll remember for the rest of his life and having come up here.
Well, there are way too many. I guess one that I will share is Diane, who has worked up here for over 30 years in Alaska, had never seen polar bears in the wild. And we were up in Kaktovik, in the far north, in Anwar, actually. And in Kaktovik, they take the whale bones and they put them out near the end of the airport runway, and we had heard that the polar bears were coming there every night. And so we went out, and we had a great opportunity to see polar bears, and we saw a mother and her two cubs feeding on the marrow from the bones there, and then, they were probably there for 15 minutes or so, and we were quite close. We kept jumping back in the truck whenever they'd look at us, we got a great chance to see them, and then we saw the mother stand up, sniff the air, get very concerned, and she swatted her babies and herded them, into the Beaufort Sea, and they swam away, and we saw a male polar bear, a big male polar bear come, and he started to feed on the bones for about 2 minutes, and then he stood up and he sniffed the air, and we thought, oh, now we're really in trouble. We really better get back in the truck. And we got back in the truck, but very quickly we saw a grizzly coming down the beach, and the male polar bear moved as fast as you could imagine a bear move across the beach and dove out into the sea and swam away. And the grizzly came in and started feeding on the bones. And that was a big surprise to me that, here's a male polar bear that's twice as big as the brown bear, intimidated by the brown bear and swimming away. But we also, I think, got our leg pulled a little bit in that community. When we landed there, our pilot said, we have to land in the daytime because the lights are out on the runway. So we landed, and I asked the some of the village leaders when we got out of the plane, so what's up with the landing lights? And they said, well, we have this one polar bear, and he comes out, and we put the landing lights back in, and he sits down, and he unscrews the landing lights, drops them on the ground, and then he moves to the next light, sits down, unscrews it, drops it on the ground, moves on to the next one. And so we think they were pulling our leg, but I talked to somebody from the Air Force not too long ago that's responsible for maintaining that field, and he said the story's true. Now, I don't know whether it's true or not, but anyway, that's one of the more memorable moments for me was up in Kaktovik.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans at the Alaska Forum on the Environment. In the first half of today's show, you heard from Annie Leonard, author of The Story of Stuff, followed by Dennis McLaren, Regional Administrator for EPA Region 10. Both gave a keynote address at the Alaska Forum on the Environment conference held in Anchorage, February 4 through 8, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.